in a strip mine cold. When you was in the morning, oh, it was light. To go down in that dark hole, come back up at night. I was born on this man. She holds me, keeps me from worry and woe. Well, they took everything that she gave, now they're gone. But I'll die on this mountain, this mountain's my home. I was young on this mountain. And I knew every holler, every cool swimming hole. Till one night I laid down, woke up to find that my childhood was over. I went down in the mine. She holds me, keeps me from worry and woe. Well, they took everything that she gave, now they're gone. But I die on this mountain, this mountain.
You're listening to Asheville Free Media, ashevillefm.org. This is The Final Straw, and I'm your host, Bursa Goodness. The show can also be heard on KXCF in Marshall, California, and KWTF in Santa Rosa, California. It's brought to you by the worker owners at Firestorm Books and Cafe at 48 Commerce Street in downtown Asheville, North Carolina. Firestorm provides organic coffee and milks, vegan sandwiches, homemade baked goods, radical literature, and a community calendar that can be found at www.firestormcafe.com. This week, we'll be speaking with Will Potter, a journalist and blogger who's been following the Joint Terrorism Task Force and FBI raids on anarchists in the Pacific Northwest of the United States. And we'll be speaking about political repression. We'll also be speaking with Brian, a member of Kitua Earth First, who was arrested in the July 28th shutdown of the mountaintop removal site in Lincoln County, West Virginia. This action was taken under the banner of the group Radical Action for Mountain People's Survival, or RAMPS. We'll hear those conversations after this short break.
It went like a forest fire. It started in a lot of different places at pretty much the same time.
500 FBI agents coming after us with a license to kill. 30 mil claiming it's just a drug bust.
They're thinking they're making a fly switch. The place for trouble for the witch. 30. out to the people in the beach. Some people are accused, some people are crime, some people get away with losing my rhyme. They don't like where I'm coming from, so they play dumb. Dumb diggity dumb, diggity dumb. Well, I'm telling you what they do. Everybody plays a fool while a real thief cools in a pool.
Yeah.
He'll got the finger on the war button. Talking loud, ain't saying nothing. TV got him bigger than life. All he needs is a knife. Who the criminal? Blind, deaf, and dumb. Hard to see them coming, but they come. Here they come. Don't be dumb, thickety dumb. Politicking right, bad checks. Still ain't getting wrecked. Going for a knick-knack. Rolling in a blue and white gang. 32 bang, biggie bang. Hanging around the hanging rope.
Nope,
nope, nope. N-O-P-E. I ain't been it for the soap.
Yeah.
Never understood why the hood half a who's in the joint. Now they got me losing my point. Gotta have it going on. Born criminal, born. Take a piece of America back. But who had it first? Hear the Indian curse. Robbed and stole so many, so much it ain't funny. Now I got them face on money. Politicians passing up bill, paid in full. See no rocking in the pocket, how they living. Making sure they locking us up, I got a feeling I'm. When it comes to something we say, what they don't like is a brother like me on the mic. In fact, to the gritty ain't none of us whack. Noriega head back,
yeah.
Jeffrey Dahmer enters the room without cuffs. How the hell do we get stuffed in the back of a cell on the aisle? Ain't it wild? What's criminal? Call to the people in the beach. One more. Time to kick the rhythm and keep a ripping down the door. So the real criminals mix both behind the clothes. Doors in the suits that make and break the law. Looking for my own cause I had enough balls. I can understand it must have been a crooked way they planned. Police forced to keep the peace, but I can't trust them, so I keep my peace. Loaded in cock cause I don't miss the block. Talk about the ones who don't get chained to the rock.
Yeah.
Mostly got away with the dirt and the grime. While we go away for the neighborhood crime. Never liked what I saw in the law. Indiana trees hanging us instead of leaves.
Yeah.
We hanging from the roof.
Yeah.
By real criminals.
They thinking of making the black swing. The place is double for the win. Dirty.
Reach up and you reach, gotta reach. Power to the people in the beats.
Yeah.
Reach up and you reach, gotta reach. Power to the people in the beats.
Yeah.
Reach up and you reach, gotta reach. Power to the people in the beats.
Yeah.
Reach up and you reach, gotta reach. Power to the people in the beats.
Will Potter is an award-winning journalist and the author of the critically acclaimed book Green is the New Red, concerning the Green Scare and the rollback of civil liberties in the United States. Mr. Potter also runs a blog by the same name. Welcome back, Will.
Hi, thanks for having me.
The Pacific Northwest of the United States has been rocked over the last week by a series of FBI and Joint Terrorism Task Force house raids and subpoenas. You've been blogging about these events on your website, greenisnewred.com. Can you talk about what apparent connections there are between those spaces and the people targeted in this investigation?
The process, by the very nature of a grand jury, is secretive, as are many of the proceedings related to these raids. But the little information we do have indicates that this is related to the ongoing criminalization and persecution of people perceived as being anarchists. The search warrants that were issued in the raids in the Northwest listed, among other things, anarchist literature and anti-government literature as items to be seized by the police. In addition to that, there's a grand jury that will be convening shortly. We don't know precisely what it's looking at, but it seems to be investigating May Day protests in Seattle, some of which destroyed corporate property. So it seems to be a connection between all of those things and using that type of criminal investigation as pretext for this fishing expedition into radical social movements.
So is this orchestration by federal law enforcement a product of the charges of crossing state lines with the intent to riot?
I think that's safe to assume. The bringing in of the Joint Terrorism Task Forces and the FBI, because this, you know, ostensibly involves political activists in multiple states.
The narrative that Dennison Williams gave to the Portland Mercury News about the raid on his house on July 25th is quite shocking. It describes the FBI busting in his door, screaming FBI, throwing a flashbang grenade, cuffing him and holding him at gunpoint while they ripped apart his house. What reasons has the FBI given for such brutal tactics? Or are they beyond the point of having to give any reasons for the sort of activity? Is this just a normalized procedure of the FBI when they're looking for literature?
I would argue it's really the latter. I mean, the FBI has given no justification for this, but if they ever actually did respond to media comments, I'm sure they would justify this on the grounds that this is a, you know, investigation into a, quote, violent crime, is how they have described it. And the officers were, you know, taking whatever precautions, you know, the same tired rhetoric they use every time to justify every manner of violence against civilians and against political activists. Unfortunately, I think this is really a pattern of behavior that's becoming increasingly normalized. Over the top violence in police raids, using these raids as a tactic of harassment and intimidation in and of themselves. So, you know, they're being used as so-called information gathering and connecting this to a criminal investigation. But the raid is a tactic of repression itself, because through these throwing flash grenades and breaking into people's homes with guns drawn and handcuffing people, this is all clearly intended to instill fear, to scare the daylights out of people, and to, through a sustained campaign of this type of intimidation, to push people out of the movement and deter them from being politically active.
In the same article, Dennis Williams states that he will not participate in the grand jury set to start on August 2nd, that he was subpoenaed to appear before. What does he face if he refuses to testify?
It's hard to say. I mean, there have been a lot of grand juries I've written about over the years, and they have, based on people's response, can have different results. Sometimes when people refuse to cooperate and they don't even set foot in the grand jury or in the courthouse, the grand jury is indefinitely postponed. It just ends. Other times, people are rounded up and brought into court, held on contempt, and sometimes imprisoned. In the case of recently, there's an activist out of Utah named Jordan Halliday who's imprisoned for multiple months and twice for refusing to cooperate with the grand jury. I mean, this was what we believe to be the first time in over 30 years that someone has been imprisoned on both civil and criminal charges for refusing to cooperate with the grand jury. So it's hard to say. Unfortunately, in the Northwest, there's a long history of using grand juries, particularly against animal rights and environmental movements, also against anarchists within those movements and outside of those movements. And they've been particularly aggressive. So, you know, we kind of have to wait and see how this all plays out, unfortunately.
How can folks support those who have been subpoenaed?
Well, there's some solidarity protests and demonstrations being planned for this week outside the courthouse in Seattle to raise awareness and to show that the people are not isolated, that they're part of a community, and that community has support. Other things going on include holding Know Your Rights workshops, teachings about grand juries involving lawyers and also involving people who have been through these processes. And I think that's something that's really valuable for everyone to be part of. What we've seen in these grand juries, it's difficult to predict when and how they'll be used. There are also grand juries going on right now in California that were investigating animal rights activists. So unfortunately, these are tools and knowledge that a growing number of activists need to be informed about. Also, I think it's important to be out there in your community and working with other political activists to raise awareness about what's actually going on. And in my work, I'm constantly shocked by the level of, the lack of awareness, not just within radical social movements, but in other social movements as well, of what's actually going on. So that's something that we can all easily take part in, and just simply talking to one another, spreading awareness about what's going on. I think a lot of people would be outraged by this.
What do you suggest people do if they are visited by the FBI, Joint Terrorism Task Force, or other state officials?
If anyone is visited by any law enforcement, the first and most important thing to remember in any situation is don't talk. It doesn't matter what is going on. It doesn't matter what you think is being investigated or what you're being told. Don't talk. I mean, that's something that this movement and many other movements, unfortunately, have kind of lost sight of. It's easy to get, you know, when you're being visited by police to let them make you believe that this is just a routine visit or whatever you're saying might be innocuous. Just don't say anything at all and immediately contact your attorney.
And just to say, it seems like if your attorney thinks that it's a good idea, or at least doesn't think it's a bad idea, that folks who are visited by law enforcement or subpoenaed to one of these grand juries should make an effort to talk to other people in the community about the situation.
Absolutely. That's a really great point in addition to what I was saying, is that, you know, I think that's critical. A lot of these tactics depend on fear, and that fear is increased when people are isolated from their community. And that fear is also increased when people don't share information about what is actually going on. So I think it's important for those who are visited by FBI to immediately tell people in their community, to tell other political activists, one, so that they can get any kind of support that they need, two, so that other people can prepare for potentially similar visits taking place. And I think to think and move forward against this type of repression.
So, Mr. Potter, you're going to be doing a speaking tour coming up this fall with Jake Conroy, longtime activist and former prisoner of Shaq 7 fame. The tour is called From Activist to, quote, Terrorist, unquote. Can you tell us more about this?
Sure. Jake and I are organizing these speaking events to continue the discussion and continue raising awareness about the tactics being used, not just against animal rights movement and not just against the environmental movement, but as we were discussing earlier with the raids against people that are labeled as anarchists, the entrapment cases against the Occupy movement. These tactics are spreading, and it's been really a driving force in my work and why I've spent so much of my time and of my life devoted to raising awareness of this issue, because it's these tactics, once they are in the hands of people in power and once they're tested and perfected over time, I would argue, that they naturally spread to other social movements. And I think that's what we're starting to see right now. I just got back from a separate speaking tour overseas and Europe, and it was really striking to me to learn how pervasive these types of tactics are becoming in other countries. In some cases, it's a direct result of coordination between U.S. law enforcement and, for instance, counterterrorism officials in Austria and in the U.K. and in Germany. We're all in contact together. In other cases, it's just a natural outgrowth of corporations who, under neoliberalism have no national boundaries, who travel freely and export their forms of backlash and their forms of repression freely as well. So the speaking events, Jake and I are putting together, are really in that spirit of trying to build solidarity across movements and raise awareness of how these tactics have been used, and more importantly, the potential for them to continue to be used and expanded against a wide range of social movements.
I'd like to take a moment to congratulate you for the recently released FBI Counterterrorism Unit review of your book, Green is the New Red. I must say that, quote, compelling and well-written, unquote, will make an apt puff quote for your next print run of the book.
Well, thank you. Yeah, it was unfortunate we didn't get those in time to put on the back cover. I think that would have been a nice blurb to have.
We've been speaking with Will Potter, award-winning journalist and author of the book Green is the New Red. Will also blogs about civil liberties issues and the Green Scare at the website greenisthenewred.com. Thanks a lot for coming on, Will.
Thanks for having me, and thanks for continuing the discussion about this.
You're listening to Asheville Free Media, ashevillefm.org. This is The Final Straw, and I'm your host, Bursa Goodness. The show can also be heard on KXCF in Marshall, California, and KWTF in Santa Rosa, California.
Well, the pillars of the world were shaken like the legs of a drunk. Hard winds rip the hats off all the ladies all about town that day. Then they caught us, ran us ragged, beat us bloody, put us in a dirty cage. Now we're screaming bloody murder, we are starving, won't see the ocean side again. Now we're screaming bloody murder, we are starving, won't see the ocean side again.
Radical Action for Mountain People Survival, or RAMPS, just pulled off an exciting action. More than 50 activists and locals organized an action alongside this banner to shut down a mountaintop removal site called the Hobbit Mine in Lincoln County, West Virginia, on July 28th. Among the participants in the action were members of Kitua Earth First, the Earth First of the region in which Asheville is situated. We are speaking with Brian of Kitua Earth First, otherwise known as KEF, about RAMPS, about mountaintop removal, and about where to go from here. Thanks a lot for joining us, Brian.
Glad to be here.
Can you tell listeners about RAMPS? What makes RAMPS different from past activist initiatives to stop projects like MTR and or mountaintop removal?
Well, RAMPS is a grassroots organization that has arisen from past groups that have been in the area. They are not supported or sponsored by a larger group or larger nonprofit organization, though, even though they do get some support from those folks in various capacities, though, but they are basically a grassroots, ground-up organization, and they've been working in this capacity for the past several years, and we don't have a huge infrastructure to rely on. They've been building this over the past couple years, and we're getting bigger, we're getting stronger, and that's what sets us apart from the other organizations. Also, we believe in direct action as a means of getting our message across. Instead of, there's other groups that just do outreach, we coordinate and plan nonviolent direct action as a means of getting our thoughts across and respecting the communities and their wishes.
So what can you tell listeners about mountaintop removal? As this is an audio show, how can you paint a picture of the actions and the effects of MTR on surrounding communities and the environment?
So imagine seeing a mountain, these beautiful pristine mountains in West Virginia, and envisioning coal within those mountains. And for the longest time, the means of getting that coal out was to go underground, extract that coal and ship it off for consumption. Well, now it's not economically viable to hire as many coal miners as before, and so they found it more profitable to just remove the tops of the mountains or blast them and access the coal that way. And the stuff that's on top of the coal is called overburden, and they need a place to put it. So they move it into what they call a valley fill. So they find the valleys that are associated or adjacent to the mountains and fill it with this overburden and therefore polluting the pristine watersheds that have been sustaining West Virginia for as long as people have been inhabiting this place. And this overburden also contains heavy metals such as mercury and all other sorts of pollutants that are definitely recognized by the Clean Water Act as being hazardous to the health of the communities. But in order to pollute these watersheds and these creeks and these forces, they've had to relocate or actually push families and complete communities out of these areas, relocate them, and permanently destroy these areas.
So if I were someone who believed in the goodwill of government, I would ask, how could this possibly be the case in the United States? Like, I could imagine something like this happening in China, where development is priority over the health of the immediate health of the population. But how can this be happening in modern day, not 1930s U.S., but today?
Well, it's a systematic attack on the people of Appalachia. They deny these coal-rich areas from economic development with no investment for the future of the people with education or economic opportunities like jobs. And so they make them reliable or relying upon the coal industry for jobs. And so they tell them this is the only way that you will survive in your backyard is by working for the coal companies, and this is the only way that you'll move forward. So they make these people reliant on the industry. Second, the coal industry is very well known for using their high profit margin to buy out the local government, local state, as well as federal agencies that would regulate this industry. It's just recently, there was a court ruling that said that EPA was far-reaching in their governing with the Clean Water Act, and therefore reverting the power back to the Department of Environmental Protection for West Virginia, which has been known to not accurately or effectively enforce the laws that are the law of this land. And so with the power reverted back to the state, which the local agencies are easier to be bought by the coal industry, though, more can get away with. It's been ongoing. There have been reports, environmental reports that have been submitted to the state, which has fallen to deaf ears. This is just the way it's been for the past several decades. And so when you think that you can reach out to those who are meant to protect you, you realize that they've been bought out by the industry.
How much of U.S. energy does King Coal provide? And also, is all of this coal for domestic use, or is it being exported?
I can't actually answer that question. The only answer that I could give you, though, is that mountaintop removal coal from Appalachia only provides 5% of the coal being used to produce energy in this country. With the current regulations against coal being put in place, though, making it harder to burn coal as a fuel source, though, the coal companies are being forced to export their pollution, meaning they're going to export the coal to third world countries who don't have the regulations in place to protect the people of that country or of this planet from the pollution that's accrued from burning coal. Basically, we can't burn coal here because it's too hazardous to our collective health. So they're going to ship it off elsewhere to at least make a final buck on it, and passing on the environmental hazards to other countries instead.
So the Hobbit Mine, run by Patriot Coal, is a unionized site, correct? Can you talk about how you relate as an IWW organizer and as an environmentalist with this is a labor struggle?
Yes, there's been a long struggle within the coal field against the coal miner and the coal company in the coal industry. As far back as the Battle of Bear Mountain, where between 7,000 to 12,000 miners rose up and fought hand-to-hand in gun battles with the coal industry to create safer working conditions for themselves and their families and actually get paid money instead of a company script. With that being said, though, there's a current struggle within the coal in the coal fields for safer working conditions that were highlighted by the Upper Big Branch disaster several years ago, where 23 miners perished at the hands of Arch Coal, at the time was Massey Energy. Currently, Hobbit Mine, it is a union mine. At the time of the protest, though, it was identified that there were not safety regulations put in place. When the miners were approached to be told that their safety regulations are not being enforced, they responded that they were doing these acts in front of their Mining Safety Health Administration, MSHA inspectors, which is responsible for enforcing these regulations. And when they were told that these inspectors had been bought by the state, they acknowledged they know this, and they know that they've been working in unsafe conditions for the past several years, though, that they don't know what else to do. This is the only job that they have, their only opportunity to work, the only way for them to feed their families. So they understand, even though that they're union and they are organized, that the MSHA does not have the best interest at mind. And matter of factly, with the UMWA, United Mine Workers of America, losing their grip on the coal fields, though, they don't feel strong enough to actually stand up to MSHA and the coal companies and ask them for better working conditions.
So what made this most recent action on the MTR site so powerful? Talk about the types of activities on the site that made this site invasion a success.
Well, this was the largest mine walk-on in the anti-MTR campaign. Over 50 people from all capacities and avenues and parts of this country walked onto an active mine site to stand up to the coal industry and say, no, we're not going to let you do this. And there was a variety of tactics. There were lockdowns to machinery. There were soft blockades, meaning they blocked the roads so people can do other things. There was a a banner dropped from a tree that was put off by a couture first. And it was a diversity of tactics and the number of people that brought to the coal field that made this and highlighted this event. I myself was one of the 20 people that was arrested as part of the Couture Earth First for doing the banner drop. And this is the first time that Couture Earth First has stepped up and done a direct action in several years, though. Couture Earth First has worked closely with RAMPS over the past year or so, and this is the first time that they've actually done their own direct action in solidarity and in conjunction with the RAMPS campaign. And this highlighted how there are folks in Asheville and in that region that are standing up and fighting mountaintop removal.
We'll talk a little bit more about Couture Earth First in just a minute, but of the 20 people who were arrested at the site of the Hobbit Mine, can you talk about the charges that people have been facing and who's in and who's out so far, and also what have folks faced on the inside?
Yes, the 20 people that were arrested, they were all charged with trespassing and obstruction of a law enforcement officer in execution of their duties. They all 20 were given a $25,000 bond, which was a surety bond, which could only be paid by putting up West Virginia property in exchange for a $25,000 bond. With that being said, though, of the 20 people, only 3 people identified themselves as West Virginian residents. So of the other folks, no one had the ability to pay, so to speak, that bond because no one had property in the state. $25,000 is quite far-reaching for two misdemeanor charges. So those were the two charges. As far as what was handed to them in the process, several folks, when they were getting arrested and processed by the state police, though, they suffered at the hands of the state troopers with police brutality. One person was identified as being dragged across asphalt on their shoulders for 30 to 40 feet, thereby ripping the skin off their shoulders and having an open wound that was not addressed for 6 to 8 hours. There were other activists that were dropped by multiple state troopers from 3 to 4 feet off the ground onto their shoulders and their head, being dragged, their handcuffs being over-tightened. Basically, what we saw was a far range of police brutality at the hands of state troopers, and this is the most excessive use of force we have seen to date of protesters within the MTR movement during their arrest. But it did not end there. After the arrest and the process, and we were shipped to the Western Regional Jail in West Virginia, we were denied basic needs for the first 24 to 36 hours. We were denied mattresses. We were forced to sleep on cold concrete with nothing but a very thin blanket. We were denied the ability to communicate with the administration by not giving us inmate request forms or grievance forms for 24 to 36 hours. We were denied handbooks to know how to function within this system, like what rules were against us, what rules we can work within, what our grievance procedures were. And once we got the grievance forms, so we were denied pens to fill out those forms. Since being in jail, though, we don't have the ability to just go out and get these items. We have to ask the guards themselves for these items, and they were denying us to every front, every way possible to communicate with the administration and have our needs met as humans.
Did outside pressure help to change the situation, or just process through when it processed through?
There was a lot of outside pressure and support, though. Once we were able to communicate with our outside support, though, when we told them about the brutality that was incurred while being processed, though, and what they were denying us on the inside, though, there was a sweeping movement of media and support and call-outs that influenced the administration to start investigating the case of the police brutality. If I'm not mistaken, the Department of Justice is now investigating the state troopers for the alleged police brutality. And there was a noticeable amount of ease on the inside when we start asking for stuff start pouring in almost immediately. We got our mattresses 1 second. Immediately thereafter, we started getting inmate request forms. We started getting everything that was needed to get things going. So it went from no one was being cooperative from the administration to being cooperative on a basic level. So yes, the outside support was very essential to being effective in that campaign.
So what kind of support does RAMPS need for these eco-warriors? What can people on the outside provide at this point in terms of supporting the people that are on the inside?
Right now, the thing that's most crucial is getting the message out of what MTR is, what's going on within Appalachia, as well as getting the message of these folks who are currently in jail so they can get the same plea deal as the folks who have been received. They're not guaranteed the same plea deal, but if we can provide the pressure and provide the messaging and spread the word to our friends, our families, and our allies, and so let West Virginia know that the world is watching, that maybe then they can get the same kind of treatment that the folks who have been released have gotten. And also, this struggle, this fight does not end at this action zone. This fight will continue. There's going to be more actions. There's going to be more events like this. And to keep that going, though, we must donate money to the campaign because, unfortunately, this struggle and this campaign is working within a capitalist structure that takes money to get things going and to keep things going. We will still need legal funds. We'll still need operational costs. And if he can support us in that capacity, that would definitely keep the fight going.
Unlike demands that you might hear from like Sierra Club or some other organization that's pretty mainstreamed and that can lobby Congress, there's no administration to RAMPS or to any of the Earth First branches, right? It's all decentralized.
Correct. There is no paid staff. None of this money goes to pay a salary. So all this money goes directly to outreach, operational costs, such as equipment to get these actions off the ground, so to speak, getting the media out there, and ultimately legal funds to bail people out of jail, to pay off people's court costs, legal fees, sometimes representation, because sometimes we can't get pro bono lawyers. So all this money goes directly to the cause itself, not to pad someone's salary.
So currently I'm sitting in a bioregion that's called Kitua. Can you talk about Kitua Earth First, or KEF, about our bioregion and about what extraction threatens us here and what we can do about it?
Yes, the bioregion known as Kitua, and Kitua comes from the Cherokee name for place, extends from North Georgia, western North Carolina, western Virginia, southeastern West Virginia, eastern Tennessee, parts of Kentucky. It's basically the southern Appalachians. And mountaintop removal is not the only resource extraction that is attacking Kitua. There's also fracking, hydrofracking, as it's called in the industry, that is the process of getting natural gas out of the ground by drilling down, inserting, or pumping down chemicals that break up the rock underground to release the natural gas so it can be extracted by the industry. And that currently is on the table for North Carolina itself, though, as it was just now recently made legal by the legislative process. So North Carolina is definitely on the chopping block for hydrofracking. And the reason this affects people, though, is that hydrofracking is a water-intensive process. Trillions, and I said that with T, trillions of gallons of water are used within the process. So all this water's got to come from somewhere. All drinking water that was available to communities will now be siphoned off using this process, though, and the resulting, the byproduct of fracking is going to be pumped into injection wells, which could also further detriment the water tables and the water sources for people. So all in all, this is a bad process on the ongoing in and coming out, and that's definitely on the chopping block in North Carolina. And that's been extensive in Ohio, Pennsylvania, New York. It's been affected, and as far as the west is Wyoming, Colorado. It's the next big thing next to mountaintop removal because since coal is being so regulated, people are selling natural gas as being the clean alternative. But as you just heard, the process in getting natural gas out of the ground is not even clean at all. And it's just another greenwashed, if I can even say that, being greenwashed solution to dirty coal.
Besides actually participating in the RAMPS action at the Hobbit Mine, how else has Kitua Earth First been contributing to this specific struggle?
We've, over the past year, Kitua Earth First has provided essential infrastructure such as water for mobilization last summer, as well as jail support and other infrastructure or logistical needs within the movement. In West Virginia, though, there's different capacities such as scouting and gear hauls and other functions that have been done in the front country and the back country. And Keturah First has definitely stepped up to the plate in that regard.
And if people want to make donations to the legal funds or legal costs for folks that have been arrested in this or in future actions, what can they do?
Keturah First is committed to covering and supporting the folks that were arrested as part of the AG, the Sandy Group, known as Keturah Earth First. People can make donations directly to Earth First at bit.ly/KEF donate. There's a link on our website at KeturahEarthFirst.org.
Where can listeners find out more information about Keturah Earth First and how can they get involved?
Keturah Earth First is currently based in Asheville, North Carolina. We have a website, KeturahEarthFirst.org, and Keturah spelled K-A-T-U-A-H, EarthFirst.org. There you can find updates about what we're currently working on, what's going on with this campaign, and we're moving forward and find ways to plug in as a person or find ways to contribute to help the cause within our region as well as the bigger region of Keturah or the East Coast.
It's notable that the organizing method that that Earth First tends to look at is by bioregion, and that those bioregions don't reflect necessarily the states as they're drawn on the map. They don't respect boundaries of electoral districts or counties or anything like that. And it seems to build a sort of network of understanding of how the ecosystems in North America and around the world interact with each other. If somebody lives in Keturah, but in Kentucky or in Virginia or in Tennessee or where have you, would they start their own chapter of Earth First in solidarity with the other Keturah and just sort of organize with it? Or what if somebody lives in an area or a bioregion that doesn't have an Earth First? How do they go about starting a chapter?
Well, since we're not a formal organization where we have chapters and memberships and all that jazz like these other groups have, we're basically an ad hoc movement, not an organization. If folks in the community want to gather together as an Earth First faction, which can happen within bioregions, there's Croatan Earth First, which is over in eastern North Carolina. They can just call themselves, they're what they want to call themselves, as Earth First, as long as they operate under the operational guidelines that we are a nonviolent direct action movement. If they want to read more, there's definitely several texts out there. They can just Google Earth First and read some of the texts that are out there. There's an Earth First journal they can read. The underlying sentiment of Earth First is that there's no compromise in defense of Mother Earth. And we do not advocate violence in that position, though, but we do acknowledge that some groups might use that tactic. But as Earth First as a whole, though, we are a nonviolent direct action group. So if people can want to adhere to that guideline, then yes, they can start their own little group and flourish in their area.
Great. Well, thank you so much for talking to us, Brian, and good luck.
Thanks so much for having us on the air.
You're listening to Asheville Free Media, ashevillefm.org. This is The Final Straw, and I'm your host, Bursa Goodness. The show can also be heard on KXCF in Marshall, California, and KWTF in Santa Rosa, California. It's brought to you by the worker owners at Firestorm Books and Cafe at 48 Commerce Street in downtown Asheville, North Carolina. Firestorm provides organic coffee and milks, vegan sandwiches, homemade baked goods, radical literature, and a community calendar that can be found at www.firestormcafe.com.
Come on. 7 feet in the chute, and we'd be picking the sled out when the breaker boss would sneak up behind us, and if he'd see a piece of sled coming through, he'd pick up the sled and hit you in the back with it, and hit you hard. And he'd say, pick that sled out, you know. Well, they used to abuse us, actually. Well, finally, we got to a stage where we figured that, well, we was going to strike. And that was when I learned my first real political lesson about what happens when you take a position against the coal operators, against the captains. Well, the first thing that happened, the union officials came to us and told us we'd have to go back to work, that we were violating the agreement. We said, to hell with the agreement, we're going to stay out on strike until we get our demands. Well, then the politicians began visiting us and putting pressure on us. Then the parish priests. Well, finally, the coal company did agree to meet with us, and they agreed to raise the hourly pay from 6 and a fraction cents to 8 cents an hour. So we got big concessions today. That wouldn't mean anything. That's only peanuts. But it meant a whole lot to us and our paycheck at that period. Well, this was my first lesson that if you stuck to your senses, stuck to your organization, and stuck together in solidarity, you could defeat them. Besides that, I learned that the politicians worked with the coal companies. I found out that the union officials were working with the coal companies. I also found out that the Catholic hierarchy was working with the coal officials. Here was a combination of the whole thing, see, that you had to pump up against the whole combination. When the coal and iron priests would find out who was trying to instigate a union, well, they'd accuse them. The miners figured, well, the only way they could fight back was to abuse them. They didn't want them to do. So they began to use them violently in retaliation of the violence that was being used against them. This kind of a struggle went on to such a degree, there was many of the mines were getting killed. There was many of the police getting killed.